This podcast contains mature content and listener discretion is advised.
Also, be advised, we are not medical professionals and this podcast is for entertainment purposes only.
This is a test of the emergency podcast system.
It is a true emergency.
Quick, run.
We love aliens.
Mystery Team Inc.
And we're in.
We're in. Welcome to Mystery Team Inc. I'm Maggie.
And I'm Kayla.
I like that you continued to do radio voice into the introduction, and it made me wonder, is it too late to just completely change our podcast personas?
What are we going to change them to?
Well, I don't know yet. I'm just saying, is it too late to completely, like, rebrand our personas?
No, not at all. No, because let me remind you, we did make this whole show up, so we can do whatever we want.
You guys, it's this is all made up.
Oh yeah. If you're a new listener, we're making this up as we go,
and any similarities to living persons, real or dead, is purely a coincidence. Do you know, I actually recently learned out I recently see, I made that up too. I'm like Shakespeare over here. I recently learned out where that came from.
Where did that come from?
It comes from Rasputin.
No, it does not.
It does. Because in 1933, Prince Felix Yusupov, who you may remember from such historical hits as Murdering Rasputin, sued MGM. Because they made a Rasputin biopic and it included the part where he murdered him. And he was like, okay, that's not what the murder was like. I should know. And no, I'm kidding. He was like, it depicted the part where he murdered him and he didn't like it, but he couldn't really sue them because he had written about it in his book and they had just done what he said happened in the book. So he was like looking for a reason, like a way to sue them. And they had included a scene that was not historically accurate involving sexual violence between Rasputin and Yusupov's wife. So he sued MGM and got the equivalent of like $2 million by today's standards, because they openly sold the movie as like, this is true, it's about a real person, and that they found that scene that was not historically accurate was defamatory toward Felix Yusupov's wife. And so that was the first time so then MGM had to destroy basically any like trace of the existence of that film. And that is why we now have the disclaimer on films and TV that say any similarities to persons living or dead is purely coincidental, even when it's based on a true story.
That's amazing, but I do have a question, which I...
Yes.
I don't know why it's only occurring to me now, but how do they get away with that? With saying, like, it's a coincidence, even though, like, it's clearly not.
Everyone knows that in order for something to be legal, you just have to say that it is, and then it is.
Oh. Okay, I didn't realize it was that simple.
And for anyone who cares, I will be doing an episode about Rasputin at some point, but...
I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, so hang on to your hats. Do you have any business?
I don't.
Should we ceremonially quack the beers? I actually have a beer tonight, but it's already open.
I have tea. But if you are listening to this and you are going to quack a beer, now is the time.
Should we do like on Dora the Explorer where they ask a question and they like wait for to answer? So this will be like that. So we'll be like,
we're Mystery Team Inc. Can you crack a beer? Good job.
Great. That was great.
All right. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So today I bring you the mystery of the Voynich manuscript.
Oh my God, it's about time.
Listen, I've been waiting to do this one for a very long time.
Oh no, I know. You know how you were like, every time I look up a mystery, I'm like, when is Maggie going to do Roanoke? Every time I fucking Google mysteries, I'm like, when is Kayla going to do the Voynich manuscript? Yeah. Or that weird thing that is like a computer, like an ancient computer that they found in the ocean. It's between that, this, and that for me.
I don't know what ancient computer you're talking about in the ocean.
It's like an object that they found in the ocean that's like 1,000 years old or something, and it's capable of doing like complex computations. They think it was used for like navigation, and it has all these moving parts, and it's like essentially like an ancient computer. Oh, do you know what I'm talking about?
I just Googled it.
You've never heard of this?
No.
Oh, I swear to God, I thought it was like number one on your list.
Never
forever.
Even heard of it. Okay, don't worry. Okay, this is moving to the top of my list.
Great.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So I've been waiting to do this for a long time. And I did purchase with my very own money a physical copy of the Voynich manuscript.
No, you didn't.
I did.
You can write that off.
I didn't even think about writing it off. I was just like,
you can write that off because we've chosen the weirdest job that one can choose for themselves. It's not even a job. We've chosen the weirdest side hustle. Like, just so far removed from hustling that you could get a tax break for buying a physical copy of the Voynich manuscript. And if that's not your definition of success, then you may need to rethink it.
I didn't even think about it, and I'm definitely going to do that.
Great.
It's one of my favorite possessions that I have now. So, Wilfred Voynich was a Polish revolutionary turned antique bookseller. In 1905, he had a successful antique bookstore in London, which he had built by going to mainland Europe and bulk buying antique books at a discount. But once he found financial success, he decided he wanted to start focusing on high-end illuminated manuscripts. And right when he decided to make this transition, he became aware of an extensive collection that the Jesuits were negotiating to sell to the Vatican, and somehow wormed his way into these very top secret negotiations, and after 9 years was allowed to purchase a few items.
He would be really big on small business TikTok.
Oh my God, yeah.
Like, he would just blow. I'm 100% sure he'd go viral. Like, and then his shit would get totally reused without his consent. Like, this antique bookshop in the heart of London is a real hidden treasure. Oh, no. And it's like some girl who's been in London for like one day. It's like 8 million views.
Oh no, they'd get overrun because I'm sure he only had 2 staff members.
Correct, yeah.
Oh no. So among the items that he purchased was something that was described only as miscellaneous 15th century manuscript. And this manuscript would become the center of Wilfred Voynich's world. Now, the Voynich manuscript, as it is called, is a small medieval codex comparable in size to a small paperback book. It has around 240 pages, 30 missing pages. So I guess it would have been 270 pages, but 30 are missing. It originally consisted of 116 numbered folios, of which 14 are now lost. Also, there's like 6 different levels of classification of like page collections that they use. And I like Googled all of them and I don't remember what any of them mean. So there's like folios and then one that starts with a Q. But we're just really going to function under, we're going to use the word section.
Award-winning research podcast. Mystery teaming.
There's too many. I'm just going to use it as, I'm going to say sections and pages.
This is their third nomination and first win.
A number of the folios have foldouts, and from what I understand, that is an unusual feature when it comes to medieval-ish manuscripts.
An angel in the centerfold?
Yeah.
That's an outdated reference. just aged myself.
I'm upset that that is considered outdated.
I'm surprised that a centerfold was like an odd or an unusual feature in a medieval manuscript. And is that just because most of the pages were paintings of goats with snail shells and knights with fish on their helmets?
And birds having meetings.
And birds having meetings with a meeting hat and everything.
I don't know why that's unusual. It was one of the things that I read was like, a lot of the pages have foldouts, which is unusual. And I was like, why? Like, why is it weird that they have, I don't know.
That must just not have been in vogue.
I know. It must not have come out until like Hallmark cards came around. You know, the ones that have like extra pages inside. And then it becomes like a triptych of a card.
Yeah.
So the drawings are painted in several shades of green and brown, a dark blue, a light blue, a red, and a faded yellow. The text of the manuscript is written left to right, top to bottom, and uses a unique alphabet that is known as Voynichese. And the kicker is, this text has never been read. Nobody knows what it says. Some of the characters resemble normal Latin characters. Some look like numbers. The rest have similarities to symbols that were used in abbreviations in medieval manuscripts. The number of individual characters is estimated between 24 and 30, but no one actually knows the actual count. The paragraphs are clearly marked. Words are separated by spaces. Some words have been found to occur often in the text. Everything about it suggests that it's just a normal text in a normal language that should be easy to figure out. The language has roots, prefixes, suffixes, and repeating spelling and grammatical patterns, but no one can decode the text.
Is the working theory that it's a language from a culture and we just don't, like, why am I blanking on what it's fucking called? What is that stone called?
Rosetta Stone.
Yes. Like a Rosetta Stone situation? Or is the working theory that it's a Latin language, like a Romance language, in code?
The answer to all of those is no, because there is no working theory.
Okay, great. That answers my question.
There isn't one.
Okay.
So, the manuscript is broken up into multiple sections by researchers. The first section, which makes up about a third of the manuscript, is called the botanical section. It has large illustrations of plants and herbs accompanied by a paragraph or two of text each. The botanical section is a source of much debate because there were a lot of herbal manuscripts made in medieval times, and most of them were just like copied over from other herbal manuscripts. But the illustrations of the plants in the Voynich manuscript don't match any plants from any other herbal manuscripts, and nobody knows what the plants are because they look made up. Like, no one can identify them.
Is the working theory that a time traveler went back in time and placed this, like, prop as a prank?
I would argue that that is just as plausible as any of the other explanations I've come across.
Great.
So there you go. You're now a Voynich manuscript researcher.
Scholar. We prefer the term scholar.
Okay, sorry. Scholar. So no one can identify the plants. And as I mentioned, no one can read the text. So we have no idea what's going on there. Section 2 is three sections that people just categorize together as one: astronomical, astrological, and cosmological. The astronomical pages, for the most part, come in two layouts. There are circular diagrams with a sun or a moon with a face in the center. Or there are like pages full of stars with words next to them, which scholars presume are like labels and names of stars. The astrological pages have clearly recognizable symbols of the zodiac arranged in similar circular diagrams to the sun and the moon with faces. But the cycle in the Voynich manuscript starts with Pisces instead of Aries, Aries and Taurus are both put in there twice, and the cycle ends with Sagittarius. Capricorn and Aquarius are missing, but there is a missing page where they should be. So the assumption is that they were lost with the page.
So the stars are right and the planets are wrong?
Correct.
Okay.
The symbols of the astrological signs are surrounded by two concentric circles, and the circles are filled with images of nude women holding stars.
Good for her.
There are so many of them in this book. The cosmological section is called that because some of the designs in that section are similar to cosmological drawings in other medieval manuscripts relating to like the months of the year or the zodiac or the winds. But the biggest part of this section is called the rosettes, which is a composite drawing on a sextuple fold-out page comprised of big circles with drawings inside of them. One of the circles has a tiny castle in it. Some of them have tiny buildings. And then the one in the center has six. The source that I got this from described it as a tower-like structure. But it really kind of, they kind of look like ZD.
Okay.
And they have, there's like a little plane full of stars. Not an airplane, but like a geometric plane full of stars above it. It has been posited that the rosettes are a map, but as with everything else in this thing, like, we don't know. Now, the next section, the best section, is called the biological section or the balneological section. This is my favorite one. I am about to send you some reference photos because you really need to, like, look at this to truly understand what I'm talking about. And I'll put this on the Instagram. It really just tickles me. So this section, in this section, there are many, many drawings of naked women bathing in interconnected tubes and baths filled with blue and green liquid.
It's called self-care, Kayla.
I read that some people likened these to the illustrations in a medieval didactic poem called De Balnei Pudiolanus, or On the Baths of Puzzuoli. But here's the thing. I looked that one up. That is very clearly drawings of people in baths. This is drawings of people in tubes filled with goo. 100%. Like, there's no way around it. They're standing in tubes of goo. I don't feel like they are. Are you kidding me? It looks like they're standing in stomachs.
Okay, there's like that one level, like three down, where it's like, yeah, what are you standing on?
And then why are they interconnected with tubes? Like, why is it green? Where is it coming from? What are they doing? I am obsessed with it. And my favorite part is that people are like, well, it's exactly like the baths at Puzzuoli. And it's like, no, because those are baths. These are tubes.
Yeah. I mean, to me, you're not going to like this, but to me, it does just look like when you go to like bath and you see like the Roman baths and stuff, like it does just kind of look like that to me, like a bad approximation of that.
But how do you explain the stomach tubes?
I don't know. Those almost remind me of, like, latrines.
Latrines. Oh, like, maybe they're toilets?
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing in there?
I will say I do think it's funny that, like, they, like, I do like the idea that, like, someone created this manuscript and it's, like, lived on to be, like, this huge epic mystery. And, like, truthfully, this was just, like, not even the best they could do. Like, or this, I guess, was the best they could do. But it's just so funny because, like, when you look at illuminated text, I mean, oftentimes it's basically this. But it's just so, it just so does not even, like, grasp a semblance of reality.
I know. It's funny that it's, like,
memorialized immortally.
I know.
in this like forever mystery. That's like
the most enduring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Literary mystery. And they're like, listen, I was having an off day. It's really hard to draw the tops of radishes. I don't know what to say.
Yes.
I think if I wrote a book about plants and then 600 years later, someone was doing a podcast, like every single plant in the book is unidentified, I would be like, I was doing my best.
I think it's even better if you imagine that it's two different guys, like that the author and the illustrator are not the same person. Because then it's like both of them fucked up. Because like we can't read it. And also it doesn't look like that. So the whole thing is essentially unintelligible. But like that's just sucks for them.
There's so many funny possibilities for how this ended up so unreadable. So the next section is called the pharmaceutical section. It consists of three double folios not bound to the rest of the manuscript, which leads most scholars to believe that the pages are not in their original order. There are drawings of objects that look like traditional medieval containers that, like, they've seen in other herbal manuscripts. Next to those containers are small drawings of leaves or roots of herbs that are elsewhere in the manuscript and therefore still unidentifiable.
I just feel like this guy, like, the author was on Fiverr and, like, found this guy and was like, so you're like an illuminated manuscript illustrator, right? And he was like, yes. And the author was like, okay, and you know how to draw plants, right? And he was like, yeah. And fountains, bath tubes, you think you got that covered? Bath tubes, yes.
Definitely sure. Bath tubes. Done a lot of bath tube work, 100%. So the final section of the manuscript is called the recipes section. It consists of 12 folios with no illustrations, just blocks of text in short paragraphs, undeciphered. So when Wilfred Voynich purchased the manuscript, he found in it a letter. This letter was sent by Bohemian doctor and alchemist Jan Marek Marcy to Jesuit scholar and polymath Athanasius Kircher on August 19th, 1665.
Are those people confirmed real people?
Confirmed real people, yes.
Because this is starting to sound suspiciously like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, where he's like, we found this book. I don't know where it's from. And there's a letter saying that I'm the king of Spain.
No, confirmed. Kircher was like a very well-known scholar in his time.
Okay.
So in the letter, Marcy writes that he is sending Kircher an encrypted manuscript that was left to him by a late friend, and that Kircher was, he thought, the only person who could decode it. He also wrote in the letter that that friend had told him that he had learned from Dr. Raphael that the manuscript had once belonged to the late Emperor Rudolf II, who bought it for 600 ducats from an unnamed messenger, and that it was composed by 15th century philosopher and Franciscan friar Roger Bacon.
Roger Bacon is actually the doctor you're thinking of, Roger Bacon's monster.
So, here's what we know. There's a way to go about telling the story that is like really convoluted, and I could be like, oh, we thought this, but then in 2009, we... No, I'm going to tell you what we know.
Great.
Because there's not a whole lot.
Yeah. Fuck that.
So, thanks to a lot of research and forensic analysis and the discovery of new documents, we have, like, pieces of an idea of the history of the Voynich manuscript, kind of. Radiocarbon dating done in 2009 at the University of Arizona dated the parchment with 95% probability to between 1405 and 1438. We're pretty sure that it's Germanic, so either Austrian or Northern Italian. From then, for 200 years on, we have no idea what happened to it. So we know 1405 to 1438, and then nothing for 200 years. There is a faint signature at the bottom of one of the pages of the manuscript that Voynich noticed in 1914, 2 years after he bought it, and then enhanced with the application of an unknown chemical. And then that signature was also much later viewed under a UV light in the early 2000s. The signature belonged to Jakob Horchicha de Tepenek, who was an early 16th century alchemist who worked in the court of Rudolf II as his imperial chemist. So there's beat one of the letter confirmed that it was owned by Rudolf II. So in his time in the court, Horchicha became one of Rudolf's favorites. And it's also said that he cured him of a grave unspecified illness in 1609.
Rasputin.
Correct. But don't say that because then they're going to sue and we're going to have to put disclaimers. Saving him from that illness earned Horchicha the title De Tepenek, or of Tepens. Tepens was a medieval castle that was destroyed in 1391, I learned. As we learned earlier from the letter, Dr. Raphael told his friend that it belonged to the emperor. So it's presumed that at some point Horchicha got the book from the emperor. I'm assuming because he was his favorite. He then signed it, which is a thing that he was known to do with all the books that he owned. We know that Marcy inherited an alchemical collection and a library from a friend of his. This friend was named Georgius Barshus, who was a minor alchemist who served as a legal official at the Prague Court of Justice. And Jakob Horchicha also worked as a legal official at the Prague Court of Justice, and they went to college together. So it is entirely likely that upon Orchicha's death in 1622, he left the Voynich manuscript to his friend Georgius Barshus, who then left it in his collection to Marcy. There is a letter from Georgius Barshus delivered by mathematician Theodore Moret to an Athanasius Kircher, dated April 12th, 1639, where he's like, I have this manuscript. I can't figure out how to decode it. I need help. I'm sending you copies. Please look at it.
Where did that letter come from? Like, who?
Researchers found it.
Okay. Unrelated to the Voynich manuscript.
No. People looking for Voynich manuscript shit found it because they were digging through the, like, old, like, archives of people who might have been related to it.
Okay.
So they found this letter. He's like, I'm sending you copies. And then he goes, I've already sent you copies, so, like, hopefully you'll respond this time, whatever. And people were like, Ooh. Well, why? So he sent him copies earlier, but we don't have evidence. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And then another letter was found from Kircher to the mathematician Moret, sent 6 weeks before the letter from
April.
In this letter, Kircher is like, yeah, so listen, I got the manuscript. Like, it would be super easy for me to decode it. Like, it's, like, really simple. I'm just, like, so busy right now.
No!
So, researchers assume that it was this letter that prompted Barshus to be like, hey, just, like, circling back on the manuscript that I sent you, wondering if I can hear about it back, like, by EOD. So, as for this Dr. Raphael, who said that he had bought the manuscript for 600 ducats from a messenger and also that it had been written by Roger Bacon, there was a Dr. Raphael. His name was Dr. Raphael Minishovsky. He was a Czech language tutor for Ferdinand III. And it's likely that he could have been privy to the purchase because he was running around in all those circles. So the most probable explanation for the early life of the manuscript is that it lived in a monastic library after it was written by God knows who.
God really does know who, because it was probably a monk.
Let me redo that line reading for you. Okay, so it should be written by God knows who. Better.
Yes.
So, lived in a monastic library in northern Italy or the southern borders of the Holy Roman Empire until it was picked up by one of Rudolf II's emissaries, who were always on the lookout for weird books and stuff because Rudolf loved that shit. That's not confirmed, but it is likely. We know from letters that Kircher received the manuscript, but we have no proof that he ever even looked at it. Most people think it just sat in his library untouched until his death, at which point his archives were housed at the Collegio Romano in Rome, where he worked. Many of them were removed and purchased over time, but the theory is that the Voynich manuscript stayed there because between 1824 and 1870, many of the manuscripts at the Collegio Romano were rebound, and the binding of the Voynich manuscript matches the binding of the other of the rebound manuscripts from that time. From there, the manuscript was saved by the Jesuits when Italy went a little bananas about religion. And then it lived in a collection outside of Rome until in 1903, the Jesuits entered into negotiations with the Vatican to sell their collection, into which antique book dealer Wilfred Voynich managed to worm. And that's how he got it. So the letter is pretty much correct. It's all been confirmed. Now, when Voynich found this letter, he immediately accepted the idea that...
He found the letter.
The original one that was like, hey, Kircher, I'm sending you this book that my dead friend left to me. I think you're the only person who can decode it. He told me that he got it from Rudolph II.
Okay. I have a theory, but I'm going to hold it.
Okay. So he found the letter and he was like, okay, so this letter says that, and mind you, he didn't know any of this proof existed. All he had was the letter. He read it and he was like, okay, so like Roger Bacon wrote the manuscript. In 1919, he reached out to his friend William Romaine Newbold, one of the world's foremost codebreakers who worked as a U.S. Army cryptographer in World War I and was a professor of intellectual and moral philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Voynich sent Newbold some pages for him to look at, and William became absolutely obsessed with decoding the manuscript. He started from the same place that Voynich started, with acceptance of the idea that Roger Bacon had written the manuscript. And in 1921, he announced that he had found the key to decoding the cipher.
Yes.
And that's where we're going to take a break.
No.
I want to hear your theory so far before we go.
Okay. I am 100% convinced right now that Voynich created the manuscript.
Okay.
Think about it.
No, I, well, he couldn't have, unfortunately, because they radiocarbon dated the pages.
Okay. Think about it. He's an antique bookseller who has access to 14th century paper. That fucking guy.
But then how did, where did he get blank for blank, blank?
Doesn't necessarily have to have been blank, could have been made blank. But, okay, did you ever see Death Among the Mormons? And it's that guy who, like, he, like, pulled off all of those, like, he... Sorry, my brain is, like, not working.
It sounds vaguely familiar, though.
He created a bunch of fake...
Yes, fake Mormon documents.
Like, Mormon documents, right? From, like, the founding of Mormonism. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, think about it. Voynich, if anyone in the world could find 14th century paper, it's Voynich. He would know enough about the history to create like a catfish, making other accounts that interact with each other to make a catfish account seem legit. He would know enough about Rudolph II and Orchicha to like create this series of letters or whatever. He could have access to old paper. He would know how to write it because he has all these old books. He also, if he... You know, they talked about, you talked about like the binding is similar to like the rebound books. It's like things that he would have access to. Like if it was similar to books that before the rebinding or whatever, I'd be like, okay, that's one thing. But it's similar to all the books that were rebound around that time, which is like probably what he would have had access to, right? Like his friend is like one of the world's foremost code breakers. I think you get those two together. They create, and that maybe that's why the illustrations are like that, because they're like an attempt at an approximation of medieval illustrations.
But okay, I have a couple problems, but why, if they're so good that they can create this manuscript, like, and match the binding and get the paper. Why are their drawings so bad? You know? Like, if you're going to go to all this trouble, why wouldn't you, like, find someone who can copy the drawings of herbs? You can't
bring another person in on that.
But, okay, why, if they can write in this new language? Also, something that people point out. It's basically
Elvish.
First of all, it does look like Quenya. Something that people point out is that there are no corrections in the whole thing. Like, nothing has been, like, scratched out and rewritten. There were, like, ways to, like, take... Like, if you fuck up in the kind of ink that was used, you can, like, scratch it off and then go over it again. Like, that didn't happen once.
Yeah, don't you think that seems suspicious?
Yes, but but if they went to all that trouble, why were the drawings
because
so bad?
You can't... Here's the thing. If you spend your life, like, studying ancient manuscripts, I believe that you could write in fucking Elvish. But the one skill in all of this that you can't just make up on the fucking fly is that. And I think that's why it looks like that.
Okay, they're just like so bad.
Because he had to draw it. And I know, but
they don't even look like real plants.
I know.
Like, they're not even close to plants. Like, someone could have... I know. Like, it's like if someone was like, draw... You know when you like ask a kid to draw a tree and it like looks like broccoli sometimes?
Yeah.
It's not even that good. Like, right. They're unidentifiable.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, I think you could fake just about every part of this. The one thing that would require someone with a different set of skills from an antique bookseller is the one thing that's not right.
I'm not convinced.
I'm just saying, you said yourself, it has foldouts, which, like, no other books from that time have, and it has no corrections, which is just, like, unreal. But it reminds me of, like... What?
I don't know. I just feel like in order to, like, source all the materials, including the ink, like, the ink is, like, appropriate to the time period. Like,
as far as we know. If you watch Murder Among the Mormons. Right. Well, if you watch Murder Among the Mormons, they do that where they, like, test the ink, test the paper. It all comes back correct. And it turns out that he was just, like, basically, like, a chemical genius. And he figured out how to essentially recreate the chemical composition of the ink that was, like, used in these old Mormon documents. And so when you test it, it looks, like, identical at, like, a molecular level.
I'm very upset.
I think about... Did you ever watch that documentary about the forger who would go to... he would go and buy, like, canvases from, like, garage sales and that were, like, period accurate. And then he would get, like, dirt... that was, like, period accurate and, like, put it in the canvas. And then he would paint, like, a Renoir. And when they would test it, they'd be like, yep, this dirt checks out. And this canvas was clearly from that period. But it was, like, he just was an artist who, like, knew what he was looking for. So he would just go find materials that could be dated properly. And then he would, like, recreate a forgery on them. And I think that's what this guy did. That's okay. My pitch.
One more follow-up. Why make it undecipherable?
Because that's the fun of it.
Oh, it's just for fun?
I think that the code breaker did that part. And I think that was, like, his contribution.
Okay.
I think they did it together for this purpose. To, like, create this unsolvable hoax, essentially. And probably to drum up business for that damn bookshop. Because qui bono?
Nobody, not a single person has boned.
I don't know. I think Voynich may have boned.
No, he didn't at all. We'll get to it. There's, like, we'll get to the second half of their story after the break. And
I think he may have thought he would bono.
Yes, he thought he would, yeah.
Well, there you go. Intent is all that matters. It doesn't matter if it worked.
All right.
I guess we'll find out why
not. We'll find out after the break.
After the break.
We'll be right back.
After these messages.
And we're back.
Welcome to Soothing Existential Nighttime Radio.
Just a reminder, folks, even though the march of time is endless, daylight savings is not. Don't forget to set your clocks back.
And coming up, tips to beat the winter blues when your dark night of the soul starts at 5 p.m. I have a new pitch.
Okay, I'm ready.
It's an adventure feature about an antique bookseller who finds a blank book from the 1500s, decides to pass it off as a manuscript from like an unknown culture. The movie's called The Voynich Manuscript, but, and it's based on a true story, but any similarities to real people living or dead is purely coincidental. And if you're playing our drinking game at home, you have to drink because I just pitched a film.
I love that. And it would be, the main guy would be played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Can the code breaker be played by Ewan McGregor?
Oh, yeah.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson as Voynich?
Yes.
That's your pitch.
That's my pitch.
Okay. We might have a hard time getting that.
Absolutely. We will not.
Getting the network to sign off on that.
Have you seen his new movie? His new Netflix film? No. With Gal Gadot? No. It's basically like National Treasure meets Road to El Dorado. And he's like the Nicolas Cage.
I've seen commercials for that or whatever, promos for that. And I think I would like to watch that movie.
It's not great, but it's a fun ride.
I know. I think I would like to watch it.
So, that's the characters that they're passing him off as now. So I think he could absolutely play our Voynich. I think it'd be great.
But isn't Voynich supposed to be a nerd?
Yeah, he's playing an FBI profiler in this one. Also played by the likes of Matthew Gray Gubler and Jonathan Groff. So I think that...
Are you sure we shouldn't just go all out and get Nick Cage?
We could get Nick Cage, but like I don't want to pull him away from making National Treasure 3.
Oh my God, we should talk about that at some point since we literally did an episode about National Treasure and part of the mystery was when are they going to make another one? I don't know if you remember that.
That mystery remains unsolved. All right, are you ready for the key to decoding the Voynich manuscript?
Yes.
All right, so when we last left Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Ewan McGregor had been like, okay, I figured out the key to the cipher. Now, Voynich had sent him a few pages of the manuscript. One of the pages that he sent him was the very last page. On that page, there is a doodle of a naked lady, a doodle of a goat, and a few lines of scribbly text. Now, Newbold, for some reason, decided that this page was incredibly important and that these lines were written half in cipher and half in plain Latin and that they were the key to decoding the entire manuscript. Why did he decide these things?
Because he would know because he's the one that coded it.
Exactly. So the first line of it wasn't like easily legible, but Newbold decided that it read Michiton, Oladabas, Multos, Te, TCCR, space, CERC, space, Portas. Then he decided to get rid of a bunch of the letters, switch in over an A, and make it read Michi, Dabas, Multas, Portas, which he translated from Latin to me thou gavest many gates.
Gates.
Gates. Benjamin Gates. So Newbold was working from the blind acceptance of the theory that Roger Bacon had written the manuscript. He also knew that Roger Bacon was familiar with the mystical Jewish tradition of the Kabbalah, and he decided that this connection to the Kabbalah is what held the key to understanding what Roger Bacon meant when he said many gates.
Is it possible that lines drawn arbitrarily around the globe are portals to another dimension? Ancient astronaut theorists say yes.
This is precisely what Newbold is doing. So he has decided that by many gates, he means that he thinks it was an instruction to combine the letters of the alphabet into pairs.
I'm not even going to ask why. I don't get it.
I don't know why. I don't know why. I don't know how he got from Kabbalah, from gates to Kabbalah to combining the letters. But I think from what I understand, there is one of the ways that you encode or do something in Kabbalah is by combining each of the 22 Hebrew letters with every other letter and with itself, which gives you 484 letter pairs. And I think this was used in like text of the Kabbalah or something like that. And Newbold was like, this is what he wants me to do. He called it the bilateral alphabet, and he was like, okay, so this must mean that Roger Bacon would have done this with a 22-letter version of the Latin alphabet. So in order for this to happen, Roger Bacon would have created a key in which each letter of the plain Latin alphabet is given 22 letter pairs from the bilateral alphabet to represent the letter. In order to decode a cipher such as this, a person would need the table showing which pairs represented which letter. And Newbold was like, yeah, I got it. I figured it out. And everyone was like, how? And he was like, don't even worry about it. I just got it. Nobody knows how, where he came up with the, like, which pairs go with which letter. But Newbold did not stop there. He then realized that if you were to make a text using this cipher, it would be twice as long as the plain text. So he was like, there's no way that Roger Bacon did that. What he must have done is used letter pairs in which the first letter of one pair was the same as the last letter of the preceding pair, therefore allowing you to double up letters and only have to write them once, and then you would expand them once you decoded it. He also realized that in order for Roger Bacon to create a text that kind of looks like words, he would have had to have rearranged the letters of the bilateral letter pairs in order to create words that kind of look like words. So he was like, well, he must have made coded anagrams then.
Have we tried holding it upside down in a mirror?
Honestly, I don't know.
This dude,
should I go do that right now?
Maybe. I'm like, how did you crack that code,
though? Don't worry, it's about to get worse. Like, we're not even done. In a letter to a friend of his named John Matthews Manley, who was a medievalist working at the University of Chicago, Newbold said that he figured out that Roger Bacon created anagrams out of letters in blocks of 55 or 110, which is so many letters to make an anagram out of that it almost seems like a person wouldn't use that many letters to make an anagram out of something if they wanted it to be translated.
It's properly. Almost like something but only a crazy code breaker would do to make something untranslatable except to himself.
Then Newbold came to a further conclusion, which was that Roger Bacon had not used a 22-letter Latin alphabet. He had actually used an 11-letter alphabet to write the original text, which relied on combining certain letters with similar phonetic values, which left Roger Bacon with the following alphabet: A, P, C, T, E, I, R, M, N, U, S.
Next time, won't you sing with me?
But then Newbold was like, but I still haven't figured out why Roger Bacon used this Voynich alphabet on top of all of this. So he returned to look at the last page with the goat and the naked lady. And to his surprise, he noticed that each letter was actually made up of nearly microscopic strokes arranged to look like a letter, reminiscent of a form of Greek shorthand that Newbold was certain that Roger Bacon would have been familiar with. So, here's his whole plan. He would identify the individual Greek shorthand marks that were microscopically made into letters, transcribe those to the 11-letter Latin alphabet, then apply the bilateral alphabet code that he figured out, and we don't have to worry about how he got there. Then expand that code, then solve the 55 or 110 letter anagram. In the three lines of text that he found the microscopic strokes on, he identified 1,300 individual Greek shorthand symbols. And the first passage that he decoded using this whole scheme read, Scripsi Rogeris Bacon, meaning I, Roger Bacon, have
we've been
this.
Trying to contact you regarding your car's extended warranty.
So that was his proposed decoding of the Voynich manuscript.
It reminds me of like when they're like in, it reminds me of in Rendlesham when they were like, and then there was all this binary and the binary gave the coordinates of ley lines or whatever. And then computer analysts were like, or it could be whatever because binary doesn't mean anything when it's just big strings of binary. Like it has to be in some kind of context.
Yeah, if you wanted it to read, I, Roger Bacon, have written this, then yeah, you could put that into Latin and then put those Latin letters into an anagram and then put that into 11 letters and then make it into tiny mic. Yeah, you can make anything say anything.
Yeah.
If you're smart, and he was. And he was doing what police often do, which is he was working to prove a hypothesis, not find out the truth.
Yeah, 100%.
So they went public with this key. And they even went on a book tour promoting it.
Qui bono.
They were like, we figured out this, the key to the cipher. It was definitely written by Roger Bacon. And Voynich was like, I will sell this to anybody for $100,000. And nobody bought it. But Voynich kept pushing it because even though they had really only deciphered like that one line, he was 100% convinced that the manuscript held secrets of world-shattering importance. But then William Newbold died, and all of his working papers were published. And John Matthews Manley from the University of Chicago, who until this point had been in very public support of his theory, looked at his working papers and was like, oh, this is total nonsense. Never mind.
Yeah.
And he published multiple takedowns of Newbold in a series of articles in both popular periodicals and academic journals. And he wrote, quote, in my opinion, the Newbold claims are entirely baseless and should be definitely and absolutely rejected. So at this point, John Matthews Manley reached out to his colleague William F. Friedman, who was the U.S. Army's top codebreaker in World War I and was considered by many at the time to be the world's greatest codebreaker. And in 1925, he put Friedman in direct contact with Voynich, and Friedman then continued an intermittent, unsuccessful study of the manuscript until World War II, which we will return to momentarily. In the late 1920s, Voynich's health began to decline, and in the last year of his life, in 1929, he made special arrangements in his will regarding the manuscript. He appointed a 5-member committee to oversee its future sale, comprised of his wife, Ethel, his secretary, Anne Nill, and 3 academic advisors who are unnamed because I guess they don't matter. Wilfred Voynich died of pneumonia on March 19th, 1930. His estate was split evenly between his wife, Ethel, and his secretary, Anne.
I see what was happening there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ethel and Anne ended up living together in New York City.
Love that for them.
For the rest of Ethel's life, they closed the London store and they ran the New York City store together. 4 months after Wilfred died, Ethel put the manuscript in a safe deposit box in a bank in New York City. During World War II, Friedman formed a group of 16 codebreakers whose job it was to break the Japanese war code. And they did that within a year. And then once they cracked the Japanese war code, the army was like, I mean, I guess you guys can like pretty much do whatever you want now. So they formed what is now called in the Voynich community the first study group and worked to decode the Voynich manuscript. Now, this is a team of people who just broke the Japanese war code. They were demobilized in 1946 and had literally made zero progress on the Voynich manuscript. William F. Friedman spent the rest of his life trying to form a second study group to try to decode the manuscript. He couldn't even set up another study group. After his death, his final conclusion regarding the manuscript was published in an essay to the journal Theological Quarterly. And he wrote, the Voynich manuscript was an early attempt to construct an artificial or universal language of the a priori kind. So at the same time that William F. Friedman was trying to decode the manuscript, a man named Theodore Peterson, who worked at the Catholic University of the United States, was also working on it. He obtained a photostatic copy from Ethel and managed to create a full transcript transcript of the manuscript's alphabet, which then just remained unpublished until after his death. Ethel Voynich died in 1960. A year later, Anne Nill sold the manuscript to Austrian book dealer Hans Piet Kraus for a down payment of $24,500 and a pledge of a half share in any future profit. And a year later, Anne Nils also died. Hans Piet Kraus advertised the book for sale for $160,000 in 1960. In 1969, he gave up on selling the book and donated it to the Beinecke Rare Book Library at Yale University, where it still lives today. So, in the 1970s, cryptologist Prescott Currier produced a partial transcription of the manuscript, and then in 1976, he produced the first Furrow computer analysis, which he claimed demonstrated that there were two distinct languages at work in the manuscript. No one else has come to that conclusion, but that's Currier's deal. In 1976, Yale professor William Bennett included the manuscript in his book about problem solving with computers, and he showed that the manuscript text had very low entropy, which meant that the range of letter combinations was lower than in normal languages, which is very interesting. I don't know what that means or implies, but I think that's very cool.
I do too.
In 1978, John Stoiko announced that he had broken the cipher and that the manuscript was actually a Ukrainian text on Slavic theology and that the illustrations were unrelated to whatever the text said. And everyone was like, go home. In 1988, Leo Levitov claimed that the manuscript was written in a modern form of Flemish and that it contains the sole surviving documents of the Cathars, which were a persecuted Christian sect that existed between the 12th and 14th centuries. Then, in 1991, computer specialist and cryptoanalyst James Gologly, I think it's Gologly, and cryptography specialists James Reeds and Michael Rowe set up an email discussion list at voynich@rand.org. They used Courier's transliteration and made a publicly available copy of the manuscript online, which made it available to the masses for the first time. In 1996, researchers Gabriel Landini and Renee Zandbergen initiated what is called the European Voynich Manuscript Transcription Project, and they developed a new transliteration alphabet called EVA, which made the text pronounceable in English for the first time, which is, I don't know, like, what that means, but that's so cool.
That is cool.
So by the end of the 90s, Zandbergen, Landini, and Brazilian researcher Jorge Stolfi were the first group to actually really look into the history of the manuscript since Voynich did. And it was they, along with translator Philip Neal, who unearthed the lost Kircher letters and the Georgius Barsius letters. In 2004, this group set up www.voynich.nu to document their findings, which remains the most comprehensive source on the Voynich manuscript. I used it for a lot of my research, so big shout out. It's just like has everything you could possibly want, and it still looks like it was designed in 2004. They haven't updated it at all.
Yeah.
So something I learned is that there is one kind of commonly accepted decoding of the manuscript. It's not universally accepted, but it is commonly accepted, which is saying a lot for this community. And this piece is actually on the last page of the manuscript with the doodle of the naked lady and the goat. The page is now known in the Voynich community as Michiton Oladabas. In 2012, on the 100th anniversary of the purchase of the Voynich manuscript by Wilfred Voynich, Johann Albus presented a reading of the last page, and this is what it says. Billy goat's liver for wet rot. At the membrane, you gave oil. Then you bring a lot of the much wax in a fixed mixture. Nine hands full, nine morsels from the only just double mature. Two words in Voynichese that they can't figure out. Squash it into a paste, then take goat's milk.
Oh my God. Do we think that the first 240, pages of the Voynich manuscript are like the beginning of a recipe blog where it's like, I love this recipe. My kids love it. I'm a mom. Throw it in the air fryer. And then the last page is just the recipe. Were they doing it for the ads? I think we're onto something.
I'm crying. Oh my God. The Voynich manuscript was written by a 15th century mommy blogger.
Just get to the recipe. I don't need to read about your kids and why they're picky eaters and why this is the only thing that they'll eat for Thanksgiving. And I don't care that you can also throw it in the air fryer. I don't have one. I need the standard cooking directions. I'm not going to freeze the leftovers. Saffron. And then they're like 9 hands full. I'm like, where the fuck am I going to get 9 hands full of the very much oil? You may have some in the back of your cabinet. I don't. I live alone. I don't have like back of the cabinet very much oil.
Back of the cabinet very much oil.
Like you seem to. Voynich.blogspot.com.
.wordpress. So, unfortunately, despite the fact that we have this one mommy blog recipe decoded, it hasn't led to anybody else deciphering any more of the manuscript. I think part of that is because this page...
No one cares about the first half of the fucking recipe.
Well, now that we know what it is, everyone's like, well, yeah. Skip it. We were going to skip it anyway. I think it's because it's this one page is like half Latin and half Voynichese, so it was an easier starting place. Not that like it was easy, but So since Johann Albus presented his findings, many other people have claimed to have deciphered the manuscript. None of them are right. They've all been disproved. In recent years, it has been proposed that Voynichese is actually a proto-Romantic language, ancient Hebrew, phonetic Old Turkish, and an Italian dialect transcribed using a well-known medieval shorthand system called Turonian notation. None of those are true. It has been attributed to Roger Bacon, Voynich himself, Leonardo da Vinci, 16th century Mesoamericans. These have all been debunked except for maybe not Voynich because of the Mormon thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some people theorize that it's a manuscript written by like an alchemist or a scientist who wrote it in code to protect their work. It was a thing that a lot of medieval alchemists and scientists did, is that they encoded their work so that only they could read it. But the thing about those is that like we can decode them, like they weren't so needlessly complicated that we couldn't figure it out. And this one is just like, we can't figure it out. All we know is that it was created between 1405 and 1438, and that whoever made it can't draw plants. And that is the story of the Voynich manuscript.
We really don't know. I'm, like, fairly convinced that he created it himself. Because I think he thought he could sell it for a lot of money. And I think it needed to be needlessly complicated and untranslatable. Because if you could translate it, then you would see that it was just BS. And also because I think the intrigue of not being able to translate it would make it more valuable. And, like, drum up interest. And
yeah. I mean, a lot of people think that. A lot of people think that he wrote it. I think that a medieval herbalist wanted to protect his secrets and just like fucked up his code and made it undecipherable. He like made some kind of computational error in like creating his code, and he was like one off. And then now we can't figure it out because it's not an actual code because he did it wrong. But I really am just like, the thing that bugs me the most, truly, is that we can't identify the plants. It's like every time I'm like, oh, well, maybe it was made by an alchemist in the medieval times. Well, then why are the plants wrong?
Yeah.
Maybe Voynich wrote it. Why are the plants wrong? Maybe Roger Bacon wrote it. Why are the plants wrong? Why are the plants wrong? I just don't understand.
I do like that it turns out that, like, the Voynich manuscript, like, the mystery of the Voynich manuscript is really just... The Voynich manuscript is clickbait. And...
It really is. It's illuminated clickbait.
Yeah. And the whole thing is, like, probably just a blog.
It's illuminated clickbait mommy blog recipes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. I mean, it's definitely like some kind of recipe herbal book, but
yeah.
And then I say that and my brain goes, why are the plants wrong? So who really knows what mm-hmm. it is, you know?
I also was thinking like maybe it was a work of fiction.
Maybe it is.
Like in a Princess Bride style where it was like, this is real, but it's not, you know, but like yeah. it's fiction and it's like meant to be that way.
But then it's unreadable.
Right. I mean, that doesn't answer the question of why it's unreadable, but it might answer the question of why the plants are wrong and why the stars are, like, slightly different and that sort of thing.
If the plants are right, then it's unreadable. If it's readable, the plants are wrong. That's it. That's the Voynich manuscript. We know so little about it. Those are my only theories. That's all I have.
I think that we will live to see it decoded in our lifetime. Or that its like origin will be solved at the very least.
Yeah, we'll either live to see it decoded or we will live to see it outed.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see which one it is. Anyway, thank you for listening.
Wow, thanks for listening.
Thank you for your theories, Maggie.
Me?
Yeah.
You're welcome.
I hate them, but thank you.
Yeah. I know, you're welcome. Thank you for that mystery.
You're so welcome. Next time I'll do the undersea computer that I didn't know about until today.
Yes.
I'm so excited.
And the next episode will be the first in a two-part series. It's going to be a big, big series of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Going to be a doozy.
It's your Christmas present, gumshoes.
Brace yourself. It's true crew crime. It's true crime down to the bone. So just be prepared for that.
Yeah.
It is crew crime. Maybe that's what we should start calling our genre.
Yes, crew crime.
Because like true crime, comedy, mystery, like they all are kind of like, sure, whatever. I think maybe crew crime is the way we should be describing it.
The crew crime podcast. I love that. Well.
We don't know.
Stay in your lane.
Buckle the buck up.
Undecipherable smooches.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.